Genesis 18. Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on since you have visited your servant. And they said, So do as you have said. As Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes. Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he hurried to prepare it. He took curds and milk and the calf, which he had prepared, and placed it before them. He was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Then they said to him, Where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, There, in the tent. He said, I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. Sarah laughed to herself and said, After I become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And the Lord said to Abraham, Why did Sarah laugh, saying, Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. Sarah denied it, however, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, No, but you did laugh. So the men rose up from there and looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. The Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. The Lord said, The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham was standing there before the Lord. Abraham came near and said, Will you indeed sweep away the righteous from the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? So the Lord said, If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And Abraham replied, Now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Will you destroy the whole city because of the 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And he spoke to him yet again and said, Suppose 40 are found there. And he said, I will not do it on account of the 40. Then he said, Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and shall I speak? Suppose 30 are found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 20. Then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and shall I speak only this once? Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. As soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place.
Any thoughts, any comments, any questions? Yes, Dave.
I think he knew right out the chute there wasn't that many people there, and how he negotiated down with God, down to 10, and he probably still left feeling like he left something on the table, you know,
all right,
trying to save that city.
Any more comments? Ellie.
It shows God's mercy, that's for sure.
Okay. Yes?
It shows why God has spared a lot of different places in the world and in our country.
All right. Yes?
In the beginning of the scriptures, it talked about three men that came forward, mm-hmm. and then it switches to the angel of the Lord. I didn't hear that term.
No, it wasn't the angel of the Lord.
I know you give that angel of the Lord, but what's... Then you'll be going into what the difference is between these men and was it the Lord that was there?
I will.
There?
Yes. I will. It's very interesting. This particular spot, it changed. And we'll get to that very fast. I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to talk about that. Yes.
So his condescending kindness towards us, and that he's willing to engage in that kind of a conversation.
Just let me get over there. A couple of people here today. Yes.
To elaborate on that point a little bit, it's like when we are praying or talking to God from mercy,
yeah,
I think he likes that, so he's willing to put up with a little bit of maybe impertinence or that kind of thing, because he wants us to be merciful. So when we act like him and we want to be merciful and we're praying, he will listen, and he will condescend to listen to that in a way that he wouldn't if we were arrogantly demanding something. But when we have love and mercy for somebody, and we're, even if we're demanding over and over and over again, because, you know, the Bible talks about praying without ceasing, you make your requests over and over and over again, he will listen to that.
Okay. You had a question?
Wheat and tares comes to mind, too.
Wheat and tares come to mind. Okay.
Well, Sarah's laughing. I've always wondered about why she denied that she laughed.
Okay.
Well, why she was afraid.
Okay, that's a good question. Any other thoughts?
I just had a thought from a cook's perspective.
A cook's perspective?
Am I to understand that he actually went out and he grabbed a live calf, killed it, skinned it, cooked it?
That day. Yeah. It's not like we do today. They didn't age their meat. I'm sorry, what?
Or refrigerator or frozen.
Yeah, right. Didn't salt. It wasn't salted down. There's a question over here.
This negates the bread, the milk and meat issue.
You had another question?
Time-wise, how long, we usually figure prayers and that are, taking more time. So, is there like a time such in this whole episode that you can figure? How much time was involved with this whole thing?
Oh.
Because, if you got to cook up...
You're talking about a prayer, or you're talking about the event that he...
Well, the whole event where he said, do not pass me.
Right,
by
yes,
bed.
Yes.
And then before you know it, he had a meal prepared that had to take time.
Yes. Remember, he wasn't this single man. He had a lot of men.
Yeah.
The men, remember, he went to war. So he had a lot of men working for him. He was a wealthy enough man that people would have those things prepared pretty quick and pretty fast. It was not like it took forever. It's not like if I had to go do it, it would take me forever. But if I had 70 or 80 men, or even 20 men, and it says, I need that thing killed and slaughtered and cleared, it's done within an hour. It's that fast or quick, Because these people are not greenhorns at killing an animal. That's what they did for a living. They always prepared for their master anything he wanted at any point in time. All right. It's a very interesting chapter, though, isn't it? A lot of questions, right? Well, I do not know if I can answer them all, but we'll go through enough of them, I hope, that we can come to address. Most of you probably figured this out. All right, now, let's take a look at the... What verse am I going to go to first? Because there's something in here, but I look at it. This actually has two events in this particular chapter. We will cover the second event a little later. But when the first sentence starts telling you something really quick, and I want to go through some of the phrases that are being used here, because of the Christian concept, they have a different viewpoint. And I may step on some people's toes today, please forgive me, but I'm going to explain in Hebrew some things that you may find strange and weird and contrary to, let's say, previous beliefs. And you have to kind of take a look at in the text that is written. And the reason why it's important is because we can judge people for doing something and it's not contrary to the will of the Creator. So the first thing we're going to talk about is Mamre. Yahu appeared to him in the plains of Mamre. And he sat in the gate of the door in the heat of the day. That's noontime. All right, we're talking noontime. Every time the Bible uses the heat of day, they're referring around noontime. All right? Because they didn't have a thing called afternoon. So we're talking about here. The sun is right there, dead center, on top. Doesn't mean that it was blistering hot. Just means that's a description of, what does the word yom mean?
Yeah, hot.
Hot! That's all the word yom means. It means hot. So when that yom is right dead center, it's hot. It's high. I mean, it's the highest point, okay, of its location where he was at. Now, the word Mamrim is a very interesting word. We'll have to go through that for just a minute, because we know where that's where he lived, right? It's where he, and this area is where Hebron was. This is the area in which he buried Sarah, his wife, and where he later was buried, and where Isaac was buried, and his wife, and Jacob, and his wife was buried there in this area. We're not in that point yet, because that contract had not been completed yet. But Mamrim is a very interesting word. It's just the name of a person, that's true, and it's a plan with this person owned, but it's got a mem in front of it. And so we have to take a look at this word. It's an interesting word to know. Basically, in a sense, it means vigor.
What?
Vigor.
V-I-G-E-R.
Okay. Vigor, vigor, whatever you want to call it. And basically, it comes from mean a strength or fatness or strength. The verb comes from me to, in a sense, the word means rebel. Place means rebel, from rebellion. The mem is in front of it, and the latter part of it is the mem re, is a meaning to rebel or rebelling. And so a particular area, we're not going to talk about in detail, but you'll understand a little bit that we come and have an idea of exactly where it was at, not where it was at, but what it's about. And to kind of explain this word, don't think it means rebellion in the sense that we think the word rebellion means. It's been translated as rebellion or explained as rebellion, but it's something a little bit different. Okay? It's not used too very often. And the reason why we cover this is because it helps us to understand why Abraham lived there. And why he had to make a decision with Mamre to buy a piece of property there. In Zephaniah, chapter 3, verse 1. Woe unto her who is rebellious and polluted. That's about the city of Jerusalem. Now, okay, so we got this one that's rebellious or polluted. Something they don't. What is rebellion, by the way, in English?
Disobedient.
What does rebellion mean in English?
Disobedient.
Disobedient. What?
To rise up against.
To rise up against, okay.
To purposefully go against what is right.
Well, not necessarily go against that was right, but just go against. All right, you can actually rebel against a leader who wants to kill your children. I mean, that's no way to rise up and go against it, okay? So it's not always a negative terminology. Now, but in this particular case, we're looking at this in the sense that we need to find out what is it means to, and basically what she said, it means to rise up. Because it says there also in the book of Job, don't have to turn there, but it says there, talk about the ostrich. Ostrich, you know what ostrich is? That's one of the dumbest birds on the face of the earth. And God created it dumb. I mean, he said it here. You don't have to go there, but I'll read it. Job 39, verse 13 is where God is correcting Job. Okay. He says, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly. They are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks. For she lays her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not her own. Her labor is in vain without concern. Because why? Elohim deprived her of wisdom. Now, evolutionary theory has something quite different, you know, you throw that out. But why did God create an ostrich to be so dumb? Well, listen. And she lifts up on high. That's the same word being rebellion. She rises up on high, and she what? Scorns the horse and its rider. So we get a little bit of a picture here of what we're talking about here. Something's rising up, not necessarily in rebellion, as we think of the English word rebellion, but we're going against something. Now, in Mamre, we have this particular that is from a person or a thing that raises up and goes against something. And, of course, later on we'll find a little more about Mamre. It has to do with Abraham and making a, quote, deal about buying a piece of property land. Okay. Now, another interesting thing. Many... I'm talking about my son for a moment. Now, he's been confronted, and he's been confronted and been challenged and sometimes attacked publicly. But there's one particular place that he had a chance to prove his point, because he couldn't prove his point before. And it's a very interesting word. I want to go through this phrase. He did extremely good studies, better at doing this than I am, because he did research on it. That's a phrase. He sat at the tent door. That's a phrase. That's very interesting. Now, when we think of a door, what do we think of?
Doorknob.
Not doorknob. All right. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing. Because remember, those who were there, that Daniel talked, there are four doors. But he's talking about this kind of a door. Not the door you open up and close in your house or anything else. This word is a very interesting word, and it's very fascinating, that phrase, because it relates to something that a lot of women here in this group are doing. Okay? But first let's go to where that phrase, door, is used. We'll go back and find out. Don't think it's the door like Dalit. It's a different word completely. Dalit means door, but this is a different kind of a door. All right? Way different kind. Genesis 13, verse 18. Oops, I'm sorry. Genesis 4. Genesis 4, verse 7. Genesis 4, verse 7. If thou dost well, shall thou not be accepted? And if thou dost not do well, sin lies at the door. And unto thee shall be its desires, and you shall rule over it. Interesting. Uses the word door, right? Now, Genesis 6 chapter, verse 18. I mean, 16, rather. Genesis 6, 16. This has to do with the ark. And a window shall make in the ark, and a cubit shall be thou art finished above, and the door of the ark you shall make set inside of it, with the lower and second and third stories you shall make of it. Genesis 19, verse 6. And Lot, remember Lot? Yeah, well, a story about Lot. We'll get more into him a little later. Went out into the door to them, went out in at the door to them, and shut it before him. So now we, okay, here's that word again. Now, I want you to turn to Psalms, 24th chapter. Very interesting here. Psalms, the 24th chapter. There's another word listed in this book of Psalms, hopefully I'll talk about it next week, which is unbelievably fascinating at the same time, but we're not there yet. At the door, remember that phrase, at the door, not a dalet, but a door, a specific door. Lift up your heads, verse 7, O ye gates, and lift up ye everlasting doors. Why? That the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? Yahweh, strong and mighty. Yahweh, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O you gates. Even lift them up, ye everlasting doors. For the King of glory shall come in. Who is the King of glory? Yahuwah of hosts. He is the King of glory. So what's that telling you?
Your heart.
It's the entryway, not just a door. It's opening up your door, your entryway into your world, into your life, and allowing the King of glory to come. It's not just opening up and saying, oh, how are you doing? You know, knock on the door, and he who opens, what is he going to do? Answer in. Okay. So we look at this thing, and when Abraham and says to Sarah, they're at their opening door, the tent, and they're allowing and permitting these three, in this case, coming into their world, their home. He begged them, remember, to come. So we got a picture here that it wasn't just hospitality. There was something more. He wanted them to come. He wanted them to stay. Lot said the very same thing to the two angels that went there. Come on in. I want you to come into my door, into my entryway. Come into my house. That's welcoming him in. So when we think about this friend that was at the tent door, we're looking at, do tents have doors?
Yes.
Yes, they do. They have entryways. Now, the gate's a different word. We won't go to the gates. But, you know, it's like opening it up and letting the Lord of glory, King of glory, come in. Yes.
It just brings to mind the scripture where the people will say, Lord, did we not cast out devils in your name?
Yeah, well,
and he says, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never
knew you.
He doesn't say you never knew me.
Me, that's correct.
He says, I never knew you.
Letting that door opening up and letting him come in. Let the King of glory come in. So we have an example here at the very beginning where Abraham allowed, in a sense, we'll get to there in a minute, the creator of heaven and earth to come into his door, come into his dwelling place where he's at and want him to stay. Of course, you know, so I get a little picture here about the door. Very fascinating. I hope you appreciate that a bit. And another one is down there, verse 2, Genesis chapter 18, verse 2. There's a phrase being used here. All right. And it says here, he bowed himself to the ground. Now, what does that mean, to bow yourself to the ground?
Humble yourself.
We're going to find out. Because in that world, back in biblical days, it's a weird, un-American thought. when we rebelled, lifted ourselves up against the, you know, English, oh, they're on the other side. We refused to what? Bow. Before whom?
The King of England.
The King of England. Not because. Why? Is he better than we? Or because we are humble? We didn't want to be humble? Why would you do that? You English, you know this.
Kind of submission. You are actually...
Well, we'll find out what it means. Because in we get the Hebrew here, it's not just submission.
It's obeisance. Honor.
It's being what?
Honor.
Honor! Simplicity being honor. You honor this person. That's what you do. Now, when we have someone bowing down between the Queen of England, what are they doing? Submitting to her or giving her honor, respect? Why? Because the eternal creator of heaven and earth says what? Honor, respect those who are in the position. Don't curse them. Don't damn them. Don't say foul things against them. You remember when the Apostle Paul didn't know who the high priest was? They didn't have mugshots in those days, you know. No computer stuff. Find out what it looks like. And he snapped back at the high priest, remember? Mm-hmm. And they said, how do you dare speak against the high priest? Apostle Paul immediately repented. Mm-hmm. On the spot repented. Mm-hmm. I did not know who he was. If he knew, he would never have said anything against the high priest. But the minute he found out, what did he do? He said, well, yeah, tough. You're not my priest. No. He humbly and quickly corrected himself. And yes.
In a sense, when you bow down to somebody, you are putting yourself under their authority. It's the reason why, for example, a president of the United States would not bow, or if she was a woman, curtsy to the Queen of England. Because you're actually putting them in a place of honor.
I understand that. But that's this world now. But I'm looking at biblical terminology. I want to look at the biblical terminology. When you look at the biblical terminology, we have to find out. You're going to find out what this word means now. We're going to find out what it really means in Hebrew. And we have a clarification of what it means in Hebrew. Because we have... The best thing I could ever teach you people is to learn to look at the Hebrew. And look at the definition of the biblical Hebrew language, not modern interpretation and clarification from all of the books and the theories and everything else under the sun that you could buy online or anybody. Look at what is written. That is a core. That's the beginning. Okay? I'm very, very verbal about that. I hope you understand that I'm very strong on you. Just think what it says, and you do your own search. See a pattern. See a pattern. See a pattern. Yes, bowing is required. Believe it or not. Okay. Genesis 22. Genesis chapter 22, verse 7. Abraham said to the young man, stay here with the donkey and the lad, and I will go. And there's a word, but mostly translated as the word worship. In Hebrew, it's the one bow. We're in our English language. And we will be back. Exodus chapter 24, verse 1. And now he said unto Moses, come unto Yahu, you and Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Bow from afar. Bow from afar. Okay, he says, oh, we got that. We know what that means. Okay, that's good. Now, let's go on now. So we need some other things, you know. Proverbs. Same Hebrew word. Proverbs, the 12th chapter. Verse 25. Would someone read Proverbs 12, verse 25?
Anxiety in a man's heart weighs it down, but a good word makes it glad.
Okay. What is the Hebrew word there that means bow, toward the ground.
Weighed down.
Weighed down, or depression. And you see, in worship, also, if it tries to say the word worship, oh, let's turn that word to worship. Anxiety of the heart caused the man to worship, but a good man makes it glad. See, it doesn't fit, does it? So he has to look at the text. What do we talk about? Bowing down. It is doing something. Now, in a physical sense, you do bow and you honor somebody who's in a position of any king. We'll see this with King David. They bowed before King David. Why? Because he's king. Here, the man bowing, in a sense, because of what? Anxiety causes him to bow down. He is so depressed. He's looking downward. He's unable to look up. So the word doesn't always mean what you think it means. You have to find a flavor behind it. Let's continue on here for a moment. Here in 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 4. So the king said to Ziba, here are all the belongings to Mephibosheth. Is yours. Now who is this guy? We'll talk about him later. And Ziba said, I humbly bow before you that I may find favor in your sight, Adonai, O king. He's talking to David. Now, is he worshiping David?
No.
What is he doing? He is, true, submitting to a request that the king has asked for. Right? So he's not in the sense of bowing down to worship. He's bowing down to give honor and respect and to fulfill the king's command. Right? This particular person, Mephibosheth is a son of Jonathan. Remember who Jonathan is? Jonathan was David's best friend. And the king said, all that your father, grandfather, King Solomon, had in his, now is yours. Everything belongs to you. This particular person had access or control over it, and so he had to hand it all back. So when we think of the word bow or the word worship, and you see it translated in the King James, you need to find out what word are we talking about. Bowing does not mean to humble yourself before somebody else. It means to give respect to and honor to. And why would you worship before God? Why would you bow before God? To give respect unto him. Why would you bow before the King of England? Do you worship him? No, we give respect. Now, that being said, Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 14. This is a future prophecy, people. And you might be surprised who's going to bow before you. Bow before you. They're not worshiping you. They're going to bow before you. All right? Verse 9:14. Thus says Yahweh, the labor of Egypt and the merchandise of Cush and the Sebans, men of stature, ones who are mighty, ones who are authority, ones who are kings and priests, leaders of the world, okay, shall come over to you, and they shall be yours, and they shall walk behind you, and they shall come over in chains, and they shall bow down to you. Same word. Now, same word's been translated worship, right? So you got to be careful how you look at these things. Don't nail everything as one word when you read that English translation. They try to move it into an area that doesn't belong. Well, now look at the word bow. I mean, okay, now, when they bow before you, and they're walking behind you, when they bow before you, what are you supposed to do? Beat them up? Why would they do this? Why would the leaders of the world bow before you? Lower themselves before you. when they are leaders of the world? Why would they do that for?
For his name's sake.
So what?
For his name's sake.
The text goes on to say, because God is with you.
Okay, I opened up the four services. I wrote, read a part in Malachi, right? All right. Now, that book, there's names being written in that book, and he's keeping the record. So if you talk often with one another and you fear the Lord, you respond to Him, you humble yourself toward Him, and you listen to Him, this is the future for you. This is the future. But you and me have to learn to bow, give respect and honor to those that are in position of authority. I'm just telling you bluntly how it is. The Word of God doesn't... I read it 3-4 Sabbaths ago about the word disesteem, what's been translated as curse. Count less unimportant than your leader. You consider him unimportant, insignificant. God says, I will curse you or esteem you lower than the one you now esteem and disesteem. Pretty powerful statement from the Creator, right? Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting if you look at the different translations of the bottom part of this text, because the New American Standard says, surely God is with you. But if you look at the Septuagint, it phrases it a little bit differently. It says, because God is in thee. So...
Well, sure, sure. It's worth it within. I had to look at that Hebrew word, but that's true. All right. So we have to look at that. Now let's go on. Okay, we got that first verse down, right? The second verse down, right? Now, let's go to the second part. What was the question? Chapter, verse 13.
Chapter what?
We're back in Genesis chapter 13, chapter 18, back in the book of Genesis. Could try my best to end this thing quickly. I'm not going to finish today, I don't think. I'm not going to finish today. You'll have to go back next week. That's too much here about... Well, to answer your question here, now, what... Okay. And Yahu, or the Lord, this is the first time this word shows up in this text. And we see now something different. Now, one of the three men was whom? What was his name to Abraham? El Shaddai. He didn't know the other name. He called him El Shaddai. What does Shaddai mean?
Mighty one.
Almighty one.
Come from the verb. What does the verb mean? The one that destroys, wipes out, purges, eliminates life. Remember, there were only 365 days or 366 days, 367 days since the flood. So, you know, that's who they remember who God is. The one that is incredibly massive in His power. Far greater. They saw witnesses of the destruction that the Creator has done. And so they called Him Shaddai, one who has power to destroy. That's what they saw. That's what took place, right? Only 8 people survived. And Shem was still alive at this point in time. So basically, I'm going to move here just a little bit, because what's happening in the Word of Yahweh, or the Lord came in, the people who write about it wrote about the event and they used his name. They didn't use the name El Shaddai when they wrote the story. But it says, so let's know that it said to Abraham, where is Sarah, or Sarah? What does Sarah mean? The good name.
My princess.
Huh?
My princess.
Let's give it. No. Sarai is my princess. What is Sarah? Where does it come from?
Lady.
What?
Lady.
The lady. All right. A lady who has what?
Prince or...
Authority, power, dignity, rulership. Because it comes from the male word. What's the male word for it? Sarah. And we know when we talk that the Messiah is Sarah, we know what it means. Yeah, he's prince, all right. And he's just not a little nice little princey guy. You know, he's really prince. He's going to rule when he father moves in and said, now you will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So we have this woman who has that kind of position and power. And I told you before that Sarah is a picture of the body of Christ. You understand what you've got to read in this, where the people behind you will walk behind you? Why? If you're part of the body of Christ, now you become his wife, in a sense. And all of a sudden now, you have, they are going to do something to you. What are they going to do? That's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to do. Why? Because you talk off with one another. Yes,
in
your
Eastern cultures, we forget about this as Westerners, but in Eastern cultures, even nowadays, people even bow to each other. They don't just bow to an emperor.
That's correct.
Or king.
Right.
There's different kinds of bows.
Right.
But you might bow to someone who's your equal, but you'll even bow to someone who's your equal.
Right,
it's
right.
Just different.
It's a foreign thing for Americans.
Yeah, it is.
But anyway, I just want to clarify that thing on the bowing. Let's go to, I'm running out of time here. I wanted to get to... All right. Before we go much farther, where am I going to go to? There's something he said to Abraham let me read it. Verse 16. Now, there's a different thought coming in, a whole different picture being revealed here. And the men rose up from hence and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on their way, or to it, like escorting them to the door. And Yahu, El Shaddai, said, shall I hide from Abram the thing which I do? Seeing that Abram shall surely come a great and mighty nation, and all nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. He says, because I know him. What is he going to do? He's going to command his children and his household, and they shall follow the way of Yahu. They'll follow the way of Eternal. Do justice and judgment. That's something pretty powerful to say about a man, isn't it? All right? But he says, verse 20, he's talking to Abram, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because of their sin is grievous, I will now go down and see what they have done according to the cry. What is the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah?
Help.
The blood.
I'm sorry, what?
The blood. Blood?
The blood.
The righteous
that are in there.
The what?
The cry of the righteous that are in the cities.
All right. Yes?
The outcry of righteous against them. The blood or even the prayers of anyone who has been undone by them.
All right. Very fascinating terminology. Yeah, it does mean to cry out. Cry out. What do you cry out for? You are in constant fear, pain, agony. And, may I make myself perfectly clear, that includes the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah. It didn't exclude the righteous. If your little child, your little girl is treated this way, your young boys, young men are treated this way, you know what they're going to do? They're going to do something. They're going to cry out. Irregardless that they know God or do not know God. Now remember, there are only 360, maybe 370 days, maybe 390 days, maybe less, from the flood. These people are in pain. That's what God heard. He didn't come down and see sin, transgression, evilness, wickedness. He heard something. Now, when God hears something, believe it or not, he pays attention when he hears something. So the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were in real sad shape. What does the word Sodom mean?
Bad.
It means burned. It got the name of that thing after the fact, not before. What the name of the area was before, we have no idea. But we know what the name of it afterwards. It was the burned city. All right, what did it get burned from? Well, we'll go to the next chapter next. Now, what does Gomorrah mean? Named after the fact, not before. Keep this part very much in mind. What does the name Abram mean? He wasn't born with that name. What does the name mean? Exalted father, or exalted father. Abraham means the exalted father of many. He wasn't born. No little girl came. No mother says, "Father, I'm going to call you exalted father, little boy." No, that's what he does. That's what he became in the very 12th chapter. God says, "I will make you this way." All right. Now, it means to be burning. Sodom means to be burning. Gomorrah. Whoops. Gomorrah. I'll go real quick on this one. Simple little word. It means chastised one. The one that's been chastised. How do you get chastised?
Brimstone.
By the fire of brimstone. It got corrected. It got chastised by the creator of heaven and earth. Now, how many righteous people were there? Not very many. Now, before we get there, I've got to try to wrap this up. I know we're late. But the secret little thing that I find very fascinating, and when Abraham went down to this thing, first he said 5, and then he moved his number. 10, 10, 10, 10.
Stop at 10.
All of a sudden, that number means something. What does 10 refer to?
Number of man's government.
I'm sorry, what?
Number of man's government.
Okay.
12 is God's government.
In Jewish tradition, that is the minimum number you have to have for a community.
All right. Oh, yes.
The lost tribes.
I'm sorry?
The lost tribes.
The lost tribe. All right. Hey, biblically, the word 10 has a very unique meaning. Biblically, it has a very unique meaning. All right. Now, we have what's called the 10 commandments. Right? And we have when the Israelites rebelled or tested God, how many times did they test him?
Ten.
All right, what did he do after that? You ain't going nowhere. You're dead from this point on. And they all were killed. Well, not all of them, but city of Mount were killed. 10 has a very significant number. How many the plagues? How many were there?
10.
All right, what else is 10?
Virgin.
The 10th month of the first. Why is it the 10th month? Or 10th day, rather, of the 10th of the first month. Why is atonement the 10th day of the 7th month? Why is 10 there? Well, to tell you something. Something comes to an end. Doesn't go any farther. What happened the first day? The 10th day of the first month? That's the last pick. That comes the end. You try to pick out what lamb you're supposed to have. The 10th day is the last one. Bamble, that's the one. Day of Atonement. 10th day. What happens there? Bamble, that's the end of it. If you don't accept atonement, you don't go into the kingdom of God. It's like a limit. God has a, believe it or not, he has not a number that's written in sand. He's got numbers written in his word. And we have to kind of pay attention to that. When you go over this thing to find out how many tens there are, and you're Abraham knocked down by 10, okay, limit. Now it's okay, 10. Guess what happened when he got down to the last 10? This is what took place. And verse 32, and he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak yet one more time." Again, that peradventure, you know, 10 shall be found there. And he says, "I will not destroy if they forsake a 10. And then what happened, verse 33? He's gone. That's the limit, Abraham. That's the limit. And there weren't 10 there, was there? There wasn't. Abraham knew. That's the end of Sodom and Gomorrah. That was the end of it. So 10 has a very fascinating word, very fascinating picture. When God uses the 10, it has a very significant meaning. Yes?
The sad thing is that even if Abraham had gotten them down to 5, they wouldn't have found that many.
They wouldn't have found many. 10 was the limit. And I think Abraham knew 10 was the limit. Yes?
And since this would seem to just be an odd little conversation between Abraham and God, it isn't just an odd little conversation. This takes up 4 inches. This is not just
No.
He's using those numbers because there's several.
There are several numbers. Usually numbers have a meaning behind it, but I'm not going to go into that today because I'm way behind time. But is there any more questions? You know, the tithe, you know, it's the 10th one in line. Not the first one of 10, it's the last one of 10 that you are to pick, right? If you pick the first one, that's not what. If you pick the second one, that's not. You pick the 8th one. No. You pick the 10th, that's the one. What if the 10th one's not as deformed? It's still the 10th one. It is mine. God doesn't take the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, or ninth. He takes the 10th one. Same thing in counting of the omer. Counting of the bushels, the wheat, the grain. If you don't have nine bushels or 9 omers of corn, you don't pay a tithe. It's the 10th one. He takes the 10th one. Those are his. They belong to him. The rest all belong to you. And if he has, why is he limited that way for? Real quick.
Why what?
Why does he say it must be the 10th one?
He doesn't impoverish those who are not doing that well.
Okay. What else is telling you? You are only to tithe on the blessings God has given you. And God names what the blessing is. If you do not have 10, God has not given you the increase that year. Why? We have to kind of ask that self a personal question, don't we? Why? Well, maybe because he's holding back for you to learn something. Or, you know, he takes something away, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, whatever he wants. But, you know, when there is an increase, then you know that God is blessing you. When there is no increase, you know, you didn't receive a blessing. Then the next thing you have to ask yourself is what? Right. Okay. Am I humbling myself? Am I listening to every Devarer Elohim? And am I responding to every Devarer Elohim? Am I instituting every Devarer Elohim? Am I living by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God? Or am I selecting the words that are proceeding out of the mouth of God? And choosing what I want to do. Brought that out, right? I don't know you. Yeah, you resurrect. You heal people. You do wonderful things. And you give the poor. Do all that kind of stuff. But if you ignore the Devarim Elohim, I don't know you. Depart from me, you who do wicked things. But I did all these wonderful things in your name. I don't know you. Why? Because you didn't respond to every word. You chose. And why the Christian world, and in the Jewish world, they kind of pick what commandments they want to observe and obey. And they pick and choose. And God has mercy. But once you know, and all of you in this room know this, once you know, you don't get to pick and choose. Yes?
I think it's interesting that in the Greek, when Jesus said your work is of iniquity, in the Greek it's anomos, which literally translated means Torah lessness.
Right, I understand that.
And so in other words, he's saying you're not been keeping the Torah.
You're not listening to my words.
Yeah.
That's what you're not.
Yeah.
And if you are listening to my words, they actually do listen to his words, they don't respond. Now that's worse. Yeah. If you didn't know the word, didn't understand the word, then you think of what city? Nineveh. He says, they don't know the right hand from the left hand. I have mercy upon them. But see, when you come and I come to know and understand what the Word of God is saying, and we choose what we want to obey and listen to, respond to, I hope we don't stand there and say, well, Lord, look what I've done for you. I preached your word. I taught these people. I guided them. And he says, by the way, no, there's a lot of more than just one jot or tittle you ignored. You picked which jot and which tittle you threw out and didn't want to, and you knew. Bad news. Bad news.